Order this meeting of the Tax Conference Committee on behalf of my partner today. I am yelling into the mic. I'm sorry.
That's your copy.
Feeling good, I guess. We're going to begin today with a list that I think you've been provided, Mr. Chairman. There are 12 items that are in the Senate bill. And we're going to start, they're not in any particular order. We'd like to start with the airport fuel change and would direct your attention. I think it's easier to look at that at the on the side-by-side at, on page 52. Tax committees have been dealing with the appropriate taxing mechanisms and the airports fund for a number of years, and this is yet another one, and it is a modification of the way in which change in the way in which we tax fuel used in airplanes, but that is not aviation fuel itself. It's gasoline. And the reason why this is a challenge for us now, or an opportunity, actually, it's more of an opportunity, is because in a couple of years, there is going to be much more widespread use because it will be approved for aircraft, generally general aviation aircraft, to use gasoline. And so we looked at different ways in which that growing trend, it's not so much right now, and the spreadsheet doesn't show a big cost, but in years to come, we think it will grow. And so what the proposal is in the Senate bill is to take the 5 cents, or is to only charge 5 cents tax on that aviation use of gasoline, and to deposit it directly into the airport's fund, and then the rest of those sections just set up the procedures for doing it. It used to be that pilots could pay the tax and then apply for a refund. That seems now be a growing reason, because the fund will be, the use of it will be growing, to skip that step and just take just charging the 5 cents to start with and put it in the airport's fund. So hope you'll take a look at those sections, and I don't know, Ms. Pollack, is there anything I missed? In a, this is kind of a 30,000-foot deal with this. Anything I missed? It's an important point. We're just taking 5 cents, charging 5 cents, putting it right into the airport's fund rather than going through a refund process, which would be current law.
Madam Chair, the application of these provisions to aerial applicators was added in committee.
Oh, that's right. And that is, there are some aviation uses of gasoline where the gas is not purchased at an airport, and that is the aerial applicators, where they may park, I don't know too much about this, but park their planes in a barn on the property, and they do their business without ever having to go to an airport. So we have a provision that applies to them too, so that they would not be subject to the full tax nor have to apply for the refund. Any questions about that, Ms. McQuay?
Mr. Chair and members, there is still allowed a refund for people who do want, and that remains as current law. It was authorized under a rule, and that was repealed and put into statute.
The second one, we'll go back to the top then. Senator Dietze, moist snuff. You want to do that one? Or whatever one you want to do.
So what this basically does is in adjusted the taxes, so we tax moist snuff on a container, and the question has become
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So moist snuff, we tweaked the taxing of this in 2013, and the question has become, what is a container of moist snuff? And so is what is happening is people are taxing, instead of the container being, you know, a small personal size container of 1.2 ounces being taxed at 95%, or, you know, the equivalent of a cigarette. And that was the purpose, and is what is happening is they're selling larger tubs. And so instead of having that taxed, if it's a 7.2 ounce tub, instead of that being taxed at, you know, the equivalent of 1.2 ounces times 7, it's just being taxed at the 7.2 ounce. And so there's kind of a disparity there, and so it's just kind of to clarify what the tax should be and how it should be taxed. And that is page 46 of the side-by-side.
Any questions? Oh, I should have asked, because I think that was a good process that you were using, Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids. The department have any comment to make either on the airport fuel change or moist snuff or both?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as it relates to the airport fuel change, we just wanted to thank the Senate for working through the definitional issues. A lot of the issues that we had brought forward were changed either in committee or with the omnibus tax bill. So we appreciate that, Madam Chair. As it relates to moist snuff, this is an issue that sort of came to our attention. Senator Dietzick had a very eloquent approach to try and correct this issue to make sure that there's some consistency. We think that the language works well. There was some small, very, very small drafting things that we have already worked with staff on. So as this moved towards final passage, Madam Chair, there will just be a little modification. Thanks.
Okay. Cigarette smugglers, Senator Dietze.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's on page 70 of the side-by-side. And so is what this does is it again, tweaks the language and tightens it so that it addresses the issue of cigarette smuggling and people that are selling tobacco products and cigarettes illegally. And it lays out a process, a due process. When the bill originally came to me, there was a kind of like a dual track where it set up additional fees and additional licenses. And we got rid of that and kept the, because currently people who are selling tobacco products have to be licensed through the local government, and so we just kind of piggybacked on that process. We increased some of those fees, and they go through the state, so we increased some of those fees. They have not been increased since 1969, so we did increase some of them, but then we saved it. We didn't do that or set up another process where they paid additional fees, and instead we did the bulk of it to go after the bad actors, and so we increased the fines, and we set up fines and penalties in a system where they can get really at the bad actors, and we did a first-time fee that, okay, if there was a mistake, if they are not able to produce if the products aren't stamped or they aren't able to produce the inventory list, then they get a fine. But if they do it a second time, that fine increases substantially, and they can also get a penalty for or 5 years of felony for willfully evading tax filing. And it's set up to align with the whole process, and there is a due process laid out quite in detail in the bill. The process aligns with the same thing if you evade on income taxes or if you fail to pay on income taxes or other taxes, and so it aligns the process so there's not inconsistency for failing to pay tax. So that's kind of the short and sweet summary, if anybody has any questions.
Okay, and this bill is in another conference committee, but the issues would be conferred here, I guess. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding, yes.
Representative Graves.
Chair Rest, what other conference committee decision?
Senator DJ.
It went into, Madam Chair, it went into, because it was there, it does actually increase the staff somewhat in to do some of this compliance issues, and so it was carried also in the State Department. Yep, yes, thank you.
And Chair Rest, when I read through the language here, I call this the smoking hot tobacco. And how many would there be to start, and how many... What kind of numbers might we be going to in the future?
You mean enforcement?
Enforcement.
Commissioner Bowerly, you want to comment on? And did you hear Chair David's question?
Yes, I did. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Chair David's. First, I would note that, yes, this is was carried as a part of the governor's proposal for the agency. And it does have an additional 10 staff that we would have to work on enforcement. It would also, we view enforcement of all tax laws as a comprehensive and a sort of a holistic approach. So we would work with retailers to educate them about the smuggling that's going on. And then we would also use these resources to go after the people who are smuggling untaxed tobacco into the state of Minnesota. And fundamentally, we really appreciate the opportunity to continue this conversation because at what's happening right now is that retailers who are following the law are wind up at a competitive disadvantage from those who are not following the law. And so we think it's important to make sure that we can help enforce the law across the board. And, Mr. Chairman, I will assure you that if this moves forward and the department is able to hire, we will hire based on their qualifications and not on their appearance.
Okay. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner and Senate, Chair Rest. Are there any safeguards at all in this to make sure we're 10 this year and then there's 20 smoking hot tobacco cops the next year and it goes to 30? And I guess the underlying question is, why do we need these folks in the first place? What's causing the smuggling? Commissioner Bauer.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Davids. We have noticed an increase in this type of smuggling it is coming in as from as far away as Illinois. As you know, other states have different tax rates, and so there is a great deal of untaxed tobacco coming in. And we have noticed that it is untaxed tobacco is more frequent than cigarettes because cigarettes carry a stamp. And so it is a little bit harder to smuggle. It's much more visible to our inspectors when they walk into a store and they can see stamps on the shelves. And so the process for getting an untaxed tobacco requires an inventory based on an invoice that retailer might have. And so it's a little bit easier. And then, of course, this is, as with, many items that people don't want to pay full price for, they can find black markets for these sorts of things.
Well, Madam Chair, and to Commissioner Bowerly, I think the underlying problem is when you're 7 or 8 times higher than your neighbors, you're going to have shenanigans, tomfoolery, and skullduggery going on. And I think that's what we're finding here. And I think it's unfortunate we have to look at hiring some smoking hot tobacco cops to enforce something that if our rates weren't so high, it wouldn't really even exist. Just about.
Representative Barrett.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, we know that people, not everyone chooses to follow all of our tax laws all the time. So there are people who avoid taxes in Minnesota, even Minnesotans who are, generally forthcoming and upright. Don't always choose to follow the law. So certainly the differentials in rates, but I wouldn't want to leave this conversation with people thinking that the rates are the only reason that we aren't collecting all the tax that is under the law.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So a couple questions, one of which relates to the amount we're talking about here. I'm looking at the our summary, and I think we have numbers in 3 different places on the spreadsheet. So I'm wondering if maybe staff could go over
sure.
I think it totals around $6 million a biennium, but I could be wrong there.
And I would point out that although there is a new spreadsheet that I think has been distributed, these numbers, that new spreadsheet came out after these numbers were put on this sheet. So I would look back for the numbers at the original spreadsheet that you got.
And
is that correct, Ms. McQuay?
Madam Chair, the numbers for the Senate position are the same on both spreadsheets. What I neglected to add was the governor's position on the cigarette smugglers, and that's what is included in the new version of the spreadsheet, which doesn't change the Senate numbers, just recognizes the fact that the governor had that position, and we're tracking it here.
Okay, and did you hear Representative Barrett's question, and if you'd run through those? I think he's asking for more explanation on the cost. Is that correct?
Yeah, if I could summarize.
Sure.
It looks on the summary, it's on on the line item 191, 266, and 460. And I could be wrong, but I think it totals $6 million. And if it does, tell me how that is broken out. Obviously, that would be paying for more than 10 police officers. So,
Ms. McQuay, what does the $6 million cover in terms of cost to the department for this enforcement?
Madam Chair and members, the cost to the department can be found, the latest number in the spreadsheet, it would be under the DOR admin, which is on line 460 of the original spreadsheet. In the department is requesting for these provisions $1.149 million in the first year and $955,000 ongoing for these compliance measures. And with that administrative money, there is compliance revenue that comes into the general fund, as well as fines and penalties. And so those three pieces together bring in the revenue offset by the new administrative requirements.
Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy, and then Mr. Chairman.
Ms. McQuay, could you sum those three lines?
Mr. Chair, members, in the first year, it's $940,000 revenue and $1.134 in the second year. So the biennial total revenue increase is approximately $2
million. So I think what I was looking at, if I could. So we have revenue increases and then expenses then offset each other. It's not $6 million. It's,
yes.
Right, got it. So if I could, just one more question.
Absolutely.
If I could. So to the commissioner, if I could, trying to understand how smuggling happens, and I mean that in a very detailed way, how do you find out about it, or how have you? Where are they? How many are there? And what do you expect the trend to be going forward? I'm just trying to visualize the situation in which people would come in with the truck, minivan, and where do they go and how do they sell it?
Mr. Bowery.
Madam Chair and members, so it comes in a variety of ways, and I'd like to ask a couple members. Mr. Dan Hughes from the department, if he could join us to tell you a little bit in more detail. As he's heading towards that side of the room, or he can join me here, I will tell you that, for example, in December, the State Patrol stopped a box truck. A rental car agency had rented a box truck to an individual who was stopped for speeding, and the State Patrol asked a couple of questions and opened the back, and we found 4 pallets worth of untaxed other tobacco product in the back of that van. So it was sort of pallets of it. And so then we began an investigation as to who actually owned it. The driver was clearly just driving it, and we follow those logical leads. That takes legwork and investigators, and so that's just one example. And I will ask Mr. Hughes of our Special Taxes Division to perhaps describe in some additional detail maybe a couple of other examples to give the members an idea of what this looks like.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Dan Hughes. I'm the supervisor of the cigarette tobacco area, Department of Revenue. And the question was about how smuggling happens, or?
Yes, how does the smuggling actually occur?
Yeah.
Right? I wanted to smuggle cigarettes from
New York.
From New York, right.
North Dakota, yeah.
Or North Dakota. How would I go about it?
Well,
and with the biggest chance of not getting caught.
We don't want to encourage
this. Are you taking notes, Senator?
Yes. I have a handout on that.
Senator, the way that would, I think that would happen, there's a lot of different ways here. If we're talking about casual smuggling or we're talking about commercial smuggling. If we're talking casual smuggling, it could be somebody who lives in Moorhead, goes across the border, and is bringing some cigarettes. They're allowed to take some cigarettes across the border, up to a carton a month. But somebody's bringing a bit more, that's more casual smuggling. Commercial smuggling is a commercial operation where they're actually bringing product here for the intent and purpose of undermining the tax, and it's a profit motive to make money selling their product. A better example, probably, it isn't cigarettes per se that is right now, you know, is not our issue. You probably heard in the news there's a lot of issues regarding cigarettes out east with Virginia because they have very low tax rate going to New York, very high tax rate. There's a whole different issue. That's not us at this point. But what we do have is tobacco. We have enterprises and entities going to different states. Whether they're going to states like Illinois, even though Illinois has a significant tax, state tax, but there's unscrupulous people that will sell them product. And they bring that into, it's kind of an old story, the old joke. It's a guy in a white van, fills up tobacco products, and he drives around and he peddles this to retailers who will buy the product and then include that on their shelves. Unlike cigarettes, the tobacco, we don't have a stamp, so we're looking at invoices to verify the product has been taxed and paid. In Minnesota, cigarettes and tobacco, the tax or the product is bought from, by our statute, is bought from licensed distributors. And so they have to give an invoice. There's requirements that we already have in our statute. And the issue is they mix in smuggled product in with product they buy legitimately. So sometimes it's difficult to find, you know, it's what we're finding. My inspectors are going out as part of our requirements is to go out and we do inspections and we verify product based on invoices. And a lot of times they won't have any invoices to verify the product and we can do a seizure. Or they'll have product just by our experience. We know they don't sell in Minnesota. There's specific products we know they don't sell here just because of the business model, and we know it hasn't been sold here. So we know it's been smuggled in. We have, we get informants. We get tips on people that are bringing product in. We exercise that process. We'd like to have a little bit more resources to, you know, exercise that process in certain circumstances. So we follow those up, and it's, you know, sometimes it's difficult to follow these up. And so we have to be proactive, and we get information, we follow through with it.
Representative Barrett?
Sure, thank you. Thank you, Chair Ross. Just a quick follow-up question. So why I wanted to kind of understand it visually is I wanted to understand visually what the 10 new people would do as it relates to the crime coming in. Can you just tell me, describe what those 10 people, probably mostly in the metro area or the metro areas, possibly one in Duluth and many in the metro, maybe not, I don't know, but what do they actually do to prevent this from happening? Are they going into retail establishments and checking records, or are they following up on tips? If you could explain that.
That's an excellent question. Yeah, that's just Representative. The issue we have right now is things change. My number of my staff changes periodically. I have roughly around 12 staff. And what my responsibility at Department of Revenue and to carry out the compliance activities, it's an audit staff. I have auditors who are carrying out their normal audit activities, dealing with distributors, things of that nature. But we also have an additional duty of doing these compliance checks, inspections. And so we're tasked to carry on not only in the inspections, but our audit duties. So what this 10 will do, for one thing, this will coordinate our efforts a little bit more. So we'll have the ability to have a real compliance efforts. Many other states really segregate those functions. They'll have an audit function where people are like auditors, like any other income, like any other tax type has auditors. And those states will have people that clearly all they do is compliance checks. And they do these inspections and things of that nature. So what these 10 will do, will do the inspections. They'll do some of the investigations. They'll coordinate with other licensing authorities, other law enforcement authorities. Plus, they're going to have a function to carry out and provide education and training to the retailers. We want to reach out to the industry. You know, we're in this together, and we want to help out each other. We wanted to accommodate the folks that are really do playing by the rules, and they're being punished by the folks who are not.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell us the rental van in December, what was its original location and its final destination?
Madam Chair, yes, Senator, my understanding, I don't have the information right in front of me, but what the question was, what was in the van or where it was intended, where it was going?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Where did it pick up the load of other tobacco products, and where was it going to unload them?
We, based on the write-up of the arresting officer, which was a highway patrolman just doing his normal highway patrol duties. This person was apprehended on 694, I think basically in Oakdale area, heading west. This product was picked up in Illinois. This is late at night. Person made his normal questioning. Highway Patrol did his very good due diligence in asking questions, and he was allowed to look at the van, and it was filled with tobacco products. He's saying he rented this van. He said he was moving officially. He was going to be moving furniture, things of that nature. More investigation turned out that, I'm going to open a tobacco shop. Well, do you have a license? No, I don't have a license. Can I look in your van? Yes, I can. It's full of tobacco. We think it was going to someplace up in the north suburbs. That's not uncommon. They'll go to a storage facility, unload the product there, and then it'll be dispersed from that point.
Thank you.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what I was wondering, I think the biggest problems, the biggest two states we have problems with, Missouri and North Dakota. Mm-hmm. Where, a couple questions, how many inspectors do we have now working tobacco? And then where would the 10 new tobacco folks, where would they be located?
Chair David, where they're, most of the inspectors, like I said, they're part of my staff, which is roughly, we're an audit staff. Between
so they are in St. Paul?
They're all in St. Paul.
Yeah. How many?
10 to 12. I mean, I'm at about 11 right now.
Okay.
They're an audit staff, and they also do inspections.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And, sir, would you be looking at illegal Internet sales? Would you be looking at all tobacco products like premium cigars? I mean, there's a lot of premium cigars smuggled because they're $3.50 tax, which is much, much more than any other neighboring state. So would you be looking at it from the Internet sales? Would you be looking at premium cigars? What's your scope?
Chair David, the scope right now is you know, if we had information on somebody who was selling premium cigars on the Internet, we'd love to have that information. I mean, they're going to investigate those things as they come up. They're going to be part of a compliance unit that'll be part of their normal functions. They're going to be doing inspections, things of that nature, investigations. If it's premium cigars, yes, we do look at premium cigar issue. We get information from other states on cigars that are coming into the state, and we do follow up on those.
Well, Madam Chair and
Representative Davids,
the gentleman testifying, of the 10 new tobacco cops, where would they be located? Would they just be in St. Paul, or would you put them around the state, like on the borders of states that have the lowest tax? Or how would you envision, where would these 10 people be?
Chairman David, right now I don't think we've really got to that point to determine exactly where they're going to be located. Our purview is the entire state. Obviously, we'd be reaching out to the outstate areas, but we haven't really made those decisions yet where people are actually going to be located.
I think, Madam Chair, and I guess there's a moral to the story here. If you're going to smuggle tobacco, don't speed.
Take an airplane.
Madam Chair.
Representative Barrett first, and yep. Then Senator Gazelka. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just a quick follow-up question, as I'm trying to understand how big the issue is. How many people has your office referred to the various county attorneys for prosecution of various tobacco laws over the past year, and how has that trend changed over time?
Madam Chair, Representative, right now we work closely with a lot of the local law enforcement authorities. Some of these things, based on our current statute, there's dollar criteria for what's level, misdemeanor, felony, those type of things. The local authorities and local city attorneys are working with us, and that's an effort we've made recently to reach out to them. I can give you that specific number. Obviously, I don't have that in front of me right now, but this is something we have several cases right now that are pending that are being prosecuted right now.
Senator Gazelka.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, I didn't realize that you only had 11 or so enforcement agents, and the proposals for basically doubling that. And I just want to know, is that the correlation because of the tobacco tax increase that we had, that is it doubling the smuggling crimes as a result of this, so you're doubling the amount of enforcement? I'm just trying to figure out why 10. You're at 11, why 10 more?
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, reason for the 10, we thought that was the right size based on the issues, why these things are happening. We've always had smuggling issues. If somebody can make a buck, they're gonna smuggle product in.
Commissioner Bowerly, did you want to add to that?
But we know we've seen an uptick in these issues, and this is an area we've made a conscious decision that we wanted to address, and so that's the reason we wanted to expand the staff.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I just wanted to add to what Mr. Hughes was explaining is right now some of this work is being done out of another division as well. We have an investigation unit that is not within the special taxes unit. And so some of the folks that work on these issues, we do a lot of cross-divisional work whenever we can. And so some of the folks who do work on these types of cases are housed in another unit. So there's at least another three or four folks who work on these types of cases and others, so it's not just isolated to those 11 individuals. Just wanted to clarify that we have more resources, and so it's not quite a doubling. It is absolutely an intentional and dedicated effort to combating this problem.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Bowerly, part of my concern, I think we've talked about it, and this isn't going to solve it today as far as being priced too high. It sort of reminds me of the Prohibition era where they tried to constrain it so much that just people went around it. And so we just want to make sure we have the right tobacco policies for Minnesota, and that's at least why I'm asking the questions.
Okay. I just want to be clear. Thank you.
Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know anything about the Senate bill, and I don't even know if there was a House author on it, but I feel I should at least comment, if there's one person in the state that should be blamed for the high tobacco taxes, it's me, and I hope anyone who feels that's a problem should call me personally. The governor did not propose raising tobacco taxes, and the Senate didn't. It was the House, and it was me. And so I would like to speak to that just for a minute. The House, the Senate, and the governor all have not proposed repealing the cigarette tax, and I think if it was such a big problem, we would have certainly seen the Senate Democrats or the House Republicans or Governor Dayton propose in this year's $2 billion surplus that we should repeal that tax, and that hasn't happened. It's been great for Minnesota, and I think what's happening right here is people are correlating the tax increase on tobacco products with smuggling. There's absolutely no data to demonstrate that. I've lived in other states. There are many states with significantly lower tobacco taxes with much higher smuggling. So I think to conflate the issues is erroneous. We know we have people in Minnesota who are in the bottom income tax bracket paying low income taxes, and people will not pay their taxes. We know we have people who maybe don't have a high property tax. They might live in rural Minnesota, and they only are due $800 a year in property taxes, and some of us in the metro might pay $8,000 a year, and yet some people don't pay their property taxes. I mean, the fact that people are trying to not pay tax, avoid laws, is part of all tax systems in the country. And smuggling, as was stated by Mr. Hughes, has been an ever-present problem in the tobacco industry since long before the cigarette tax was raised. And so I think, I'm not arguing for the Senate position. I don't even know what the bill was, but I'm listening to people kind of thinking it was that tobacco tax increase that caused smuggling. And it existed before. When the states around us catch up, and if you look at the history of the tobacco taxes in Minnesota, you will see that Minnesota goes up first, and then everyone follows, and then Minnesota goes up, and everyone follows, and that's been a pattern in Minnesota for 50 years. And so if it was the price of the tobacco that caused the smuggling, then when Wisconsin catches up to us, which they will soon, then we should see all the smuggling go away. And I can guarantee you that's not going to happen. These are attempts, whether it's in this industry or others, there are always people who are attempting to get something for nothing or avoid tax. And there's all kinds of smuggling of all kinds of things going on that are taxed and non-taxed in Minnesota. So, I may be the only voice crying in the wind, but I want to take full responsibility for the cigarette tax increase in Minnesota. I'm actually disappointed that there's a little bit of erosion going on in some of these bills. But, again, I don't have a comment on this legislation. I don't know if additional enforcement is needed or not. I don't have an opinion on that. But I would hate to see legislators make that decision based on the tax, because if that's really the problem, we should have been seeing the legislature putting bills to repeal the cigarette tax. And as far as I know, no legislator in either party has done that. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lencheski. Representative Kraskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if someone can review for us. I see there are several tax increases in these sections here, raising the fee from $300 to $500. I don't know enough about the licensing process and what a subjobber does. Can someone outline what these are? And
Senator Dietzick, the increase in the fees.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dukowski, as I mentioned before, some of these haven't been raised since 1969. And so there's 44 cigarette distributor licenses. They were at, they're currently at about 150 a year, and so we are upping them to about, I think it's 500. The cigarette subjobbers, which is basically part of the wholesalers, and it actually is a defined term in statute. I think they're at 25 now. We're upping it to 100. The tobacco distributors, there's about 268 of them. We're increasing that, I think, to about 500. And then the tobacco subjobbers, we're going up to 100. And so we have increased that. And part of that is we do want a barrier, so we don't want the person who is in just, taking their little white van and going down to Chicago and filling it up. We want them to stop and think twice so that they, if they really want to be a tobacco distributor, that they go and, get that license. And so it is to make them think twice and be a barrier. We don't want just the casual person just going out and doing this. And so we do want them to have that license and let them think twice about getting it. And then later on in the bill, there are penalties so that if you don't have the inventory list or you don't have the tax tobacco, the first one is $1,000. And so that's, if you maybe can't find the receipt or whatever, it's, not the big. And then the next one we increased to $3,000. So if you are penalized twice, that's when it double hits you, because then it's no longer an accident. You are, it's not just a mistake. If you get it, two times in X amount of time, we hit it harder. And so that's kind of what we did.
Thank you.
Any other questions on the tobacco smugglers' provisions? Any further comment from the commissioner?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hughes. We will then go to Tofte Housing. This is a provision from Senator Bach, but Senator Skoy is going to tell you what that's all about.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And Tofte is a community along the north shore of Lake Superior. And they are struggling with housing for their, I wouldn't say senior citizens, but older residents. And they have come before us asking for the same authorities of a housing authority that a city would have, but they're a township. They have had some conversations with the county housing authority, but the county housing authority, because of a couple of very large projects, was unwilling to add this bonding capacity. So the town of Tofte is asking for this housing authority in order to build 12 units of housing for individuals over 55 as they try to progress their, you know, up the housing so that these senior people can move into the housing in Tofte and somebody else can buy these homes and they can have this progression of housing for individuals.
Any questions on the Tofte housing provision? Commissioner Bowerly, did you have a comment?
We don't have any comments at this time, Madam Chair.
Number four was to, is a repealer. Senator Scoy, you want to talk about the ag containment facility?
Yes, members, and this is a provision that was put into law back in the 90s, exempting what at that point in time would have been the relatively small fertilizer plants that dotted Minnesota. And it was an effort to encourage them to put secondary containment around their liquid chemical storage units. So they were receiving this pollution or this property tax exemption for this pollution control. This has been in place since the 90s. The industry has changed significantly since then, and this exemption has not been broadly used. There's around $6 million of exempt property currently in the state. There is some question now with the language after we did the bins and tanks discussion of a couple years ago as to whether some of the roofs and walls of these containment structures shouldn't be considered exempt as they could be construed as containment. That, from my perspective, was never the intent, and I was uncomfortable with the thought that this property tax shift would occur off of the fertilizer chemical facilities and onto homeowners in those towns. I know from my personal experience that these facilities have always tried to be good neighbors, but there still are some questions in communities about the locating of these, and I thought that if they were to shift property taxes off of their facilities onto their neighbors, it wouldn't be good. The other thing that has occurred is the industry's changed dramatically since the 90s. As I said, every small town used to have a small fertilizer facility, and now there's been significant consolidation. There has a lot of improvements and upgrades been done that really is unknown as to whether it would be included or not included in the pollution control exemption. Having said that, we don't know what the assessors would do. Some appear to be taking the approach that that should be exempt. So the original bill in the Senate, the original language in the Senate bill is to repeal that pollution control exemption. I have been having some conversations about perhaps there is an optional to a total repeal where we would go back to what would be more in line with the original intent was to try to deal with any potential water contamination that might have occurred from these facilities. So if they were doing liners on the ground to contain a spill or a berm to contain a pollution spill, we would provide the exemption for that, but we would clearly state that the buildings and the roofs were not going to be contemplated as an exempt for pollution control purposes, because this is a pollution control exemption. So we are working on some language, but at the very least, I would hope to have that ready for us in tomorrow, maybe. But otherwise, I think we should contemplate a repeal of this because of the potential shift onto the homeowners of the property tax, because it hasn't been being assessed that way, but there is some risk that it would be in the future. And I'm not going to remember the numbers exactly, but I think it's about $76 million of value that would be shifted on to homeowners. And it currently is around $6 million of exempt properties. So the scale of this could get quite large if we don't do something to address it this year and give clarity to the assessors out there.
Questions on that provision? Commissioner Bauerlein? Or Mr. Cummings?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as Senator Scoy noted, in the 1990s, most of the facilities that had chemical containment were wet chemicals. And so a lot of the ag chemical containment was in smaller type of facilities. Over time, a lot of the technology has moved to dry facilities. So we're seeing a different kind of structure than what was seen in the early 1990s. That is creating a time in which people are trying to figure out how is this assessed. We are ensuring that under the next assessment that all of these will be exempt. I would like to ensure what we want to do is make sure that there's clarity within our property tax system. So I think that by providing guidance to county assessors, we will ensure that there's clarity. I think that Senator Scoy's bill will also provide clarity to assessors, which is important, and to provide some fairness across the state. In addition, as it relates to the amount of shifting, Senator Scoy's bill would provide not as much shifting as would occur if there may be just a direction to change the assessment across the state. So that is something that we are considering. I would just want to caution that as we try and look and figure out what is primary and secondary containment, that we're told that because it's been moved from wet to dry, that distinction is much harder because a wall may be used as both the structure to hold up the building and also the primary containment for the chemical. The roof is, because it is dry and the chemicals may be just put into a side part of it, it may also have the primary containment of the dry chemicals. So if we're trying to distinguish between primary and secondary containment in this last week of session, I think that might be a difficult task to have if we're trying to find a meaningful way to distinguish between those two. With that said, Mr. Chair, we're open to looking at any language and trying to work through any issues.
Any questions? Further questions? Senator Scoy.
Just a quick follow-up to what Mr. Cummings said. This really did result from the question we had with regard to the assessing of bins and tanks for fermentation for brewers and creameries and ethanol plants. And in some of these facilities, it really was hard to distinguish between the wall of the building and the tank because they were basically the same thing. And that had gone on for a while, so it was a pretty significant issue that we were dealing with before the legislature got involved, and we found some resolution. I would hope that we could find some resolution to this before the issue gets any larger.
Okay, thank you. The next, Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment maybe. The majority of the conferees are Greater Minnesota conferees on both sides of the table here, which is unique and interesting. And just a comment, and I don't know what Chair Davids thinks going forward, but that whole bins and tanks thing, I thought that was a nightmare. And I, looking at Mr. Cummings and all of you, and not just because I'm a Metro legislator and didn't really understand it. I mean, even once I think I kind of understood it, I thought it was a nightmare. And before that, I thought the sugar beet processing value assessment, that was another nightmare. What is a sugar beet processing facility? And I remember Representative Erdahl used to try to do the dairy credit, and we went up to his district and looked at these milking machines that were like as big as houses. And is just for people from the suburbs, it's just another world. You know, it's like walking around on Mars when you guys all talk about this stuff. So, you know, to this issue, it seems like this one's a whole bunch of complication again. And are you trying to get Chair Davids to resolve it once and for all, Mr. Chair? Or are you hoping that Chair Davids takes a look at it in the future and starts unpacking it? I mean, I'm just trying to understand, because I've thought all of these things, and maybe for Chair Davids and the other House conferees, they get this completely and they know exactly how they'd feel about these things, but it sounds like kind of a doozy. So,
Chair Schoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lencheski. I am trying to resolve it before it gets to be a larger issue. I think it has the potential to be as large of an issue, or maybe even larger than the bins and tanks one for ethanol. And yes, and it's the same kind of discussion. It's the same kind of issue that we had with sugar beet plants. It's all the same, only this is small now. And one of the facilities that came in and talked to me about the impacts has never paid tax. They're brand new. They've never been built. And it seems to me that it wouldn't be an impact on that because they're brand new. And the shift isn't occurred there yet. But it would be good to resolve this year so it doesn't get to be a larger problem that we all have to deal with. And the question is, I mean, this is truly a local property tax issue. It doesn't impact state other than the Department of Revenue. It's if we're going to shift these taxes off of these facilities and onto everybody else. And that's the question. And for my town that I live in and farm in, the anhydrous tank is no longer in Clearbrook. It's now two communities over because they didn't like it there. And it seems to me that in order to locate in a community, they should be good neighbors and pay their share of the property tax, and then the neighbors will have less objections to the facility. That's the way I view it. But I think we should resolve it so it doesn't get to be a larger issue, would be my hope.
Any other comment? Okay, thank you. The next issue, number five, is a CRP land, and it's on the side-by-side on page 22 as well. So, Senator Schoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think I'll direct this directly to Representative Lencheski, because I'm pretty sure that CRP would be outside of the realm. Also, but no, what we have is we have Conservation Reserve Program lands. They are agriculture lands. They had agriculture activities on them. They have to be planted. They have to be kept weed-free. They have to be mowed. And they receive an ag payment. And they should remain ag land for classification. This is clarifying language to ensure that that happens. There is some question with regard to CRP language that was enrolled after 2002. I believe, as to whether it should be made ag land or a different classification, because it's not technically growing a crop because it's in the Conservation Reserve Program. We think for these farmers, this land should remain ag land. It should be that way for property taxes. It's receiving an ag payment, and there's weed control and mowing going on, and it should remain ag land.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Chair Rest. And maybe to the department, but hasn't CRP land always been class two? Have there been some counties that have moved it to a different classification? Madam Chair, I just always thought that CRP land
it's
was
a,
class
it's
two.
It's a time effective thing. If it was agricultural in 2002, it is, but not necessarily after that. And that's
so, Madam Chair, are you aware, Chair Schoy, have there been some counties that have been not classifying
it as agriculture?
CRP as agriculture? What are they classifying it as?
Madam Chair.
Senator Schoy.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I have the same question as you. I don't, you know, the law says right now it has to be classified in there either in 2002 or in the year prior to enrollment, and I'm not sure what is being missed that needs to be picked up with this language. But Mr. Kloxheim would be a better.
Well, I guess the question is, do we have a patchwork since 2087, different counties doing it different ways?
Commissioner Bowerly.
No. Madam Chair and members, I'd like to ask Mr. Kloxheim of our Property Tax Division to help answer some of these questions if you're amenable.
Welcome to the
Mr. Chair.
Table. Go ahead.
My name is John Kloxheim. I'm the Property Tax Assistant Director. I don't see this as it being really a big change. Our guidance to assessors is fairly clear on this matter. The only situation where I could envision that CRP would not currently qualify under this is for something that was classified, was enrolled in the program after 2003. It's pretty difficult to find a situation where this would exist.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think there was one county, Senator Eakin brought this, I think there was a county up in his area that was going to start reclassifying this land. So he brought the bill. I had the same response that you did. Why would they do that? We said, well, let's clarify what we think this is going to be. So this is what we're trying to do. And as long as I've got the floor, I'll make a pitch for assessor accreditation. Because it's clear that a little ongoing training is a good thing for these folks because we want to be consistent across the state.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Chair Rest. And to the gentleman, in this case, what were they going to classify it as, this county?
Sir?
Most likely, Chair, if it was not classified as agricultural 2A class, it would then move to probably 2B. Rural vacant land.
Well, Madam Chair and to the gentleman, I mean, isn't by definition CRP land, isn't that going to be ag land after the 10 years is up or whatever time period you have? Wouldn't that automatically revert back to two?
I don't think there's a time period on this provision.
Well, Madam Chair, isn't most CRP for 10 years? So when the ag land comes out of CRP, it would be ag land.
Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, we're going to try to get a hold of Senator Eakin. I think they were going to classify it as rural vacant lands.
That's what he said.
But I'm not positive, so we'll find out. And I had all the same questions as Senator Eakin that you had. This is why are they doing that? And he said, well, he didn't know, but that's what they were doing. So we're trying to clarify that CRP is ag land, which I think all of us sitting here think it is and think it's what it should be.
And Madam Chair, if it was changed to vacant land, would that be a lower rate?
Sir?
Madam Chair, it depends.
That's helpful.
What did he say?
It's got to be higher.
Well, I'm kind of rethinking this, that if it goes to 2B, Madam Chair, it's a better rate. Maybe we should go to 2B until it comes out as ag land after. Just trying to help middle class, Mr. Chairman.
Madam Chair.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we heard this in the Property Tax Division in the House, and Representative Marquardt brought the bill, and there was the same confusion, and we cussed and discussed it, and we still didn't know a lot more. It seemed that there may have been an individual example that we weren't able to really drill down to, that we might be chasing our tail with this one around one example is what I gathered, but we didn't have any conclusive discussion.
Madam Chair, I think
Senator Skoy.
I think that's right. I think it's one county. You know, Representative Marquardt would be a House member serving with Senator Eakin. They would have one county assessor that would be doing something different, and they're trying to make sure that that isn't the case.
Okay, anything further? Number six is the use of a levy for a historical society. It seems that current law says that if general fund dollars are to be support of historical society. It has to be directed to a county historical society, and what this provision allows is general fund dollars to be in support of an historical society that's located in a city or a town, and it doesn't necessarily have to go to the city doesn't have to give money to the county historical society. It's a small glitch that a city historical society, a small one, I guess, brought to us. And I don't remember the author, Senator Scoy.
I don't recall.
I don't remember who it is, but it's just something different that we have.
So Madam Chair, yes, to that sir. Provision, instead of having to go to a county historical society, for example, the town I live in, Preston, has a very active historical society. Mm-hmm. Grants can be made directly there.
Yep. Yes. That's what the provision is.
Thank you.
Sure. The next one, seven, is a unique situation in St. Louis County that Senator Scoy is going to explain, I hope.
Madam Chair, always interesting dealing with my good friend Senator Tomasoni. This is a provision that goes back a number of years, and it's dealing with a parcel of land that is above land that is eventually going to be mined. And a number of probably years and maybe even decades ago, the parcels were split. So they had a different identifying number for the house than they did for the land. And now they're getting to where the houses are going to be empty and they're going to be torn down. And they still have this different identifying number for the houses and for the land. And the county came to the Senate Tax Committee and requested that we combine the two and put the responsibility of the houses on the landowner. And we didn't think that was exactly right, so we didn't do that. But we were somewhat sympathetic to the county and the costs associated with this. So in order to resolve an issue that, without some help from the state, we saw complicating, we told St. Louis County that because there's probably $5 to $6 million in costs associated with demolishing these homes that are on top of land that is eventually going to be mined, and we didn't think the landowner should be responsible for them, that the county should bear the most of the costs, but the state would pay $1 million of it to help find a resolution to a complicated issue of having two different identifying numbers on houses and land on the same parcel.
Mr. Chairman, this was an issue that I don't think, well, I've been here 30 years, that ever encountered anything like a parcel of land being both personal property and being homesteaded, depending on your point of view. And instead of really trying to come up with some sort of general law change, we thought that by a grant that we would help resolve the issue going forward without complicated redoing of a property tax PIN, you know, identification numbers, and going through huge changes with regard to those, what is it, a couple of dozen?
Madam Chair, properties? I think there's 60 buildings.
60 buildings.
Total, and they're going to demolish 12 in the next year, something along those lines.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Chair Rest. Now, the buildings, were they owned by individuals on leased land? Like, do they have like a 50-year lease, or so? Really, they own the house, but the mining companies have rights to the land.
Yes.
Not exactly.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, not exactly on a couple of levels. because the land is not all owned by the mining companies. Some of it's owned by other entities that will do whatever with it. And the houses, I think, might have been owned by the mining companies and rented to the landowner or the homeowner.
But
people who are living in them got homestead treatment for the houses.
For the CRP of their houses.
Basically.
I said, well, unlike anything I have ever seen.
Okay, Madam Chair, should this just be confined to St. Louis County? I mean, how many counties are considered the range? If you will, I mean, don't you have Itasca?
This is an anomaly that has not occurred anywhere else.
Because I was wondering if it's happening in St. Louis County, is it happening in Itasca or Itasca?
No.
It's a mess.
There you have it.
Just think that probably is a result of a conference maybe 100 years ago sitting right at this table.
Creative county commissioners. Back in the day. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Can I just understand a little bit? So, Senator Tomasoni, you don't want us to understand.
You really want to understand this, don't you?
Isn't he the chair of the Jobs Committee? Why can't Deed come up with this out of their target? Isn't this a jobs thing? Isn't this mining? In the House, you know, we have a... what's it called? Outdoor and Mining Committee.
Outdoor Recreation and Mining.
But in the Senate, isn't it the Jobs Committee has mining in it, too?
It's environment.
It's environment.
And all, yeah. But doesn't it have both?
Economic
all
development. Okay.
So, you know, I just would point out that the chair of the House Tax Committee has a problem in Houston County, as you heard about, in tax reciprocity, and I just... Just curious, Senator Tomasoni, he's looking to Senator Scoy to work on this problem. Is it? Doesn't sound like a tax issue now. It just sounds like a grant. You've converted a tax issue into an appropriation.
In order to, Representative Lincheski, in order to solve a problem that did not involve intricate, complicated property tax policy that would serve as a precedent for anybody. And as is sometimes the case, the best answer is write a check, be done with it, and then it goes away, we hope. And nobody is going to claim that that's good tax policy, but the alternatives are certainly beyond the capabilities of the Senate Tax Committee in dealing with the issue. Maybe you guys can come up with a better approach, but we could not come up with a principled one based on property tax policy that would not harm I don't know that I call them innocent, but that would not harm people who nobody would want to harm.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, and if I may, I'm just trying to be helpful.
Thanks.
Because, you know, we do have, I don't know, 5 or 6 days, and at the end of the day, you know, this committee is going to get a target, and then people are going to work this out. But these things will remain separate from the target in that there's problems, and I agree with you. Sometimes the best thing is just to write the check, particularly when you have to take on bad tax policy instead. And I just hope, as the Senate is concerned about this provision and other ones that we've heard about over the last few days, that they will think about the concern of the House tax chair, because I've been thinking more and more about tax reciprocity. And we've all got the same problem, and Chair Davids, you know, you can see he knows that too, that there's so much, as Commissioner Bowerly walked through, riding on this whole tax reciprocity issue that's beyond what is in Houston County, and we all understand that, yet it, you know, fundamentally is a problem, and Chair Davids is trying to solve it. And I was listening to Representative Barrett talk about Taylor's Falls and his border city issues. And I was trying last night to think through a border city's sort of credit that really had nothing to do with income tax reciprocity for the people of certain counties of some margin who are affected by, you know, some level, trying to think through an aid, which we have done repeatedly, or we've done an appropriation to just solve a problem. And so I haven't come up with that yet. But this kind of provision makes me think that if the Senate is trying to get creative in appropriating funds to solve problems, that they might want to think about how the House can solve some problems too. And I don't know how that would work, but it certainly seems to me that by the end of the day, people might want to put on their thinking caps on how to solve tax reciprocity, because I think we all know that chairs usually have bottom lines about things they want to get done before they adjourn. And I'm just glad to hear the Senate say sometimes it's easier to write a check than do bad tax policy, and I would agree with that.
Representative Davids.
I certainly agree with what Chair Lencheski had to say. That being said, the grant to St. Louis County, is this traveling in any other bill in any other conference committee? Is this like someone can put in four or five places?
Not this one.
The old,
not this one.
The old Representative Kahn thing that we've all learned from her over the years.
We have the opportunity and the privilege of being the only conference committee to carry this provision.
You ask sometimes, where is that provision in 84 places?
You know,
this
here.
Is just here. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if we want to hear from St. Louis County, but I know I talked to Mr. Ungaro, and there's like 70, I remember the number in my head, 70 additional properties that have not been tax forfeited yet, and they're most concerned about this expanding into that, and apparently there's some language that they, I haven't read that part of the bill, but there's that language, in order to prevent the same situation from occurring in the future, was their priority in this rather than the $1 million. And as I listened to them, it seemed to me that the responsibility for this, fell onto the mining company rather than the county. But anyway, that's what I remember from the discussion.
Representative Drazkowski, I think the mining company would have a different perspective on it. So. But certainly that's a very good point in my mind to whatever we do here, that we don't do something or we neglect to do something that would allow the situation to be perpetuated in another area.
Yeah.
Because a mining company wants to reassert their rights to the land to mine it. So. Anything further, Senator Spoy?
Thank you, and I would just add one more thing with regard to the county's concern. The county is the organization that split these pins to begin with. I have less sympathy for them than one might think a former county commissioner would have. They caused this problem.
Representative Davids?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back when St. Louis County did this, what were they thinking?
What?
Well,
we'll talk more. Okay, then. Number eight, seasonal rec. Senator Spoy, that's
sure.
You again. This is a provision that, although some of us think of it as having a split rate classification for seasonal rec, it's tied to our attempt to give statewide business property tax relief. But Senator Spoy, why don't you?
Sure, Madam Chair and members. This is a provision we talked briefly about when we were talking about the statewide business property tax levy. The Senate has, over the years, tried to find a mechanism to have school districts in these areas bring their values that they have in their property tax area to bear on their school levies. We have run into the policy discussion that these seasonal rec facilities are not into the decision-making of the school, and they shouldn't be part of the levy of the school. And so the seasonal rec are outside of the building levy component. They do pay into the statewide general levy. So as we looked at the proposals that we're working on with regard to the statewide general levy, including the one in the Senate bill, we thought that we needed to take a little look at what was going on with regard to the seasonal rec component of the statewide general levy. What occurs to me is that these higher valued parcels are truly not seasonal recreation. They are much more comparable to what a resident non-homestead would look like. And while there we're not proposing that they be split classified, we are proposing that there be a limit, and then when the value is reached, they would be taxed as if they were residential non-homestead, which for anybody over $300,000, the value over $300,000 would then go into the local jurisdiction and would also fall on the school building levy and the voter approved referendums, I guess, is my memory serving me right there. But I don't think these are your traditional cabins that people think about lining Minnesota lakes that are seasonal. These are, you know, high-valued homes. They're not freezing up in the wintertime. You know, they're not draining the water out of the lines and more of a seasonal. They're more of a residence that should be treated like that.
Representative Stanton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, sorry. Just kind of a question. Obviously, I don't. We have a few lakes in our neck of the woods in southwest Minnesota, but you know, looking at that and from a value perspective, and how that could potentially affect some districts, and you know, from a percentage of total value within the school district, when you're talking about a building project or from that, how could that potentially kind of off? You know, it could kind of lump a lot of the value within a certain district, maybe maybe in the Brainerd area or Gull Lake or kind of in those districts. And, you know, from a non-voting to a voting side, if you've got, you know, a consistent amount of lake space that's higher value, that you could kind of upset the balance of how that works within the whole district and push a lot of that burden onto some homes that, you know, maybe have some fluctuation in value, but... I'm just a little concerned, like, if there would be, like, maybe a better idea would be if you did move some of this forward. I don't necessarily support it, but have kind of a limitation on the top and the bottom so that you've kind of got a window of exposure to that and then continue to allow it. You know, so you're not, you know, if you've got just high value homes that may have a lot of exposure that, you know, because I don't know how the values work a lot of times, but... I don't know, just a little concern
sure.
on that, I guess.
Madam Chair and Representative Swazinski, the impact to an individual parcel depends upon the school district that they're in and what the levy is for the buildings in that school district. So it's really hard to identify a parcel and say this is going to be the impact to you, because you could have very comparable structures in one school district where they would be receiving a tax benefit from this, in another school district that has a large building levy that's being supported, it could be a tax increase. So it's really difficult to identify that. If you look at this on a statewide basis, I think the cost to remove the seasonal rec from the state general tax is 40-some million dollars a year. I think that's what it is. And as I have had bills to do that in the past, there are a number of things going on. So you take them out of the statewide business property tax, the state loses $43 million in revenue. You put that into the school formula base, and school districts pick up some of that revenue. But the net tax impact to the whole seasonal rec category is a reduction in tax, because some of those are in school districts that receive equalizing from the state. So it's quite complicated. You can't really look at a building and say you're going to receive a reduction or an increase. For me, representing areas that does have a little more seasonal rec, it's always been kind of a tough spot for us because, you know, some school districts have as their tax base skyscrapers, and some have ag land, and some have lakes and cabins, and it's really hard when you take part of the property out of the school district and say, you know, you can't include that in your revenue source. And so I've always kind of gone a little farther the other way. Senator Rust, on the other hand, representing New Hope and areas where a lot of those cabin owners live, truly the seasonal rec cabin owner, has had a different point of view on this. So for this year, we kind of took this tentative step that we think is this conference committee has conversations over the next few days about property tax relief and statewide general levy changes. This should be part of the conversation. What are we going to do with the seasonal rec component of that if we're making changes to the overall statewide general levy?
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you remind us again what the Senate bill does in terms of the state general tax on seasonal rec?
It takes $9 million worth of value out of the 43, and the value that it's taking is the value that's on homes over $300,000 in value. So there's drawing a line on. So you've got a say you've got a $400,000 cabin and lot on a lake in wherever. $300,000 would stay in the statewide general levy. $100,000 of value would go into the local tax base.
And if there wasn't a referendum there, it would be that $100,000 would not be taxed.
Because they wouldn't have tax.
And so that was the way in which there was relief given, ostensibly through the statewide general levy on that $100,000. So that's the way in which the seasonal rec property participated in that by splitting. I call it, staff doesn't like us doing that, but it's a split rate kind of thing. And so they get the relief on the $100,000 if they're in a community that doesn't, that's not voting to have a referendum. And putting and that $100,000 would be on referendum market value. That's how it would be taxed. It's a way of not bringing the seasonal rec property totally into back to what it was prior to 2001, where seasonal rec was in some districts that districts or those communities commercial industrial property because they don't have anything. It's a surrogate for that. That's what they use it for. And yet, you know, many of those same cabin owners or seasonal rec owners are in their homes, let's say in the metropolitan area, they're already paying property taxes based on where they had a chance to vote for school referenda, and they didn't in their where their cabins are, and there was a lot of momentum at one point 20 years ago to say, well, cabin owners ought to be able to vote two places. They ought to be able to vote where they live and they homestead and their permanent residence, and they ought to be able to vote their property, seasonal rec property, on school referendum. What we know it, or it was assumed, if that ever happened, none of those referenda in lakes areas would ever pass because the cabin owners would claim that they would receive no benefit other than a generalized benefit of enjoying an educated population. They receive no specific benefit from paying for the schools in an area where they not only didn't have children, but they really had no grounded stake in the communities. And one of the things we did was put them with the statewide general levy, because they were acting like CI in many instances, and take them, remove them from the some of the responsibility for local school taxes. And my communities, I don't know if it's the same now, but 20 years ago, my district had the largest number of cabin owners in the state. And they didn't have these $300,000 homes or even the equivalent, but they're older families, long-term families, passing things on from generation to generation, and they had their cabins on the lake, and that's where they vacationed. Representative Drazkowski, and then Senator Scorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the Senate bill doesn't do anything for the valuation under $300,000 then for the seasonal rent?
No.
Okay, thank you.
It's achieved in a, maybe it's a Rube Goldberg kind of way, but sorry, Senator Scoy, but I think that's what it is. But anyway, it did bring about some relief. Senator Scoy, and then Senator Gazelka.
Before Senator Gazelka, to the point of residency, this country, property ownership does not entitle you a right to vote. Residency does.
That's right.
So that's pretty clear. They're not going to go there. And we do have parcels of property that have ownership in different school districts, businesses, CI, that the owners live somewhere else, and they put up with whatever properties the locals assess on them. So going to, that is not an option for Minnesota,
and
in my opinion.
And that same argument has been made frequently of the owners of CI property. And I don't mean the big corporations, but a small business owner who, pays the school district with regard to the operating referenda, and then lives in another community and pays it there as well, and only has the opportunity to influence it at the ballot box one place. I'm not saying that that's a valid argument, because I agree with you, but it is. I think that it's not unreasonable to have an acknowledgement of. Not everyone lives and works and is in the same school district across the state. It just doesn't happen. Senator Gazelka.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I have East Gull Lake area of Gull Lake, and it has a lot of Senator Rest cabin owners are up in my area. And I was honestly concerned that their taxes would go up too much because, that could destroy the market. And people may not want to buy there. So we ran the numbers, and it actually looked like it might be a little less because of the present referendums in the schools, so it was a win for them. But there's going to be winners and losers all across the state, and we just couldn't figure that out.
Depends on what school district.
Yes, exactly. But the winners clearly are the residents, the permanent residents in those communities that have referendums. It's going to be spread out more, or those school districts are going to be able to collect more because they can have a referendum a little bit higher. But it appears, at least in my area, that it wasn't a negative for your cabin holders.
Senator, Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just hearing it, I would be interested to know if Chair Davids is interested in pursuing this later, if the Department of Revenue can provide us with two pieces of information, which is, where are the cabins over $300,000? So which districts are the big winners? And where are the owners of the cabins over $300,000? Because we all know we all have tons of cabin owners, but I have a suspicion about who has the residents who own the cabins over $300,000, not who has the most cabins in their district.
We might find that they're non-Minnesotans.
Yes. For example, my cabin is in Wisconsin. So, we know there's a lot of that going on, and it's taxes on cabins are treated very differently in Bayfield County up on Lake Superior in northern Wisconsin than they are in Minnesota, but that's not for this committee. I would be interested to know that, because I think if the Senate is trying to address school funding by, you know, grabbing the value over $300,000 by putting the cabins onto the. No, I thought part of this is to get that value over $300,000 to pay for the schools in those areas. Is that not correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Lencheski, that is an outcome, but that is not a result. We're looking at the statewide general levy changes and thinking that if we're doing anything there, we're going to have to do something to address these parcels. We think that this is a good way to address the seasonal rec component of the statewide business levy. An impact there is going to impact schools. I mean, that was part of the conversation why when they went into the statewide general levy back in 2001 was to this voting component.
Well, and okay, so thank you, Madam Chair. So if that's an ancillary goal or part of the proposal, I mean, that's one thing. But, you know, as somebody who I think might represent some of those cabin owners, I think that they might see that a little bit differently as to what really happens there. And I agree that there are school districts like mine, for example, that have lots of commercial industrial property. And it really is unfair for the communities, particularly in rural Minnesota, who can't just go to the big buildings and other properties to spread those levies. So I get that. I hope that if what you're really trying to do is work on the CI, that's different. But if you're looking for the school funding, you should look further at Chair Drazkowski's proposal. Because as a suburban legislator and metro legislators, I guess I would speak to you, probably the negative impacts of the Senate proposal and the House proposal probably disproportionately fall in the metro. But it, to me, seems a fairer proposal, if you are a metro legislator, to look at what Chair Drazkowski's doing. And he's doing an ag, I think he calls it a bond credit, he can tell you himself, but, you know, that the farmer gets an income tax credit, which, of course, we would all pay for. So that's why people in the metro contribute to that farmer's property tax relief to help fund those schools and pass those referendums. So if that's part of Greater Minnesota Legislators' goal here, I think there's a larger base to spread it across in Representative Drazkowski's proposal. So I hope you would look at that. And I do think if you understand his proposal, if you're a Greater Minnesota Legislator of any party, you will probably like it, Democrat or Republican. I think if you're a metro legislator, Republican or Democrat, you have to think about it a little bit further since your constituents will put into the pot and not receive anything. Yet that is how our education funding works anyhow already. And so, I hope you'll compare your proposal to Chair Drazkowski's proposal and just think about that a little bit because I think he's got a pretty good one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lynch, a couple things. First of all, I think the assumption that average cabin owners are going to pay more is incorrect. They will pay less if you take the statewide average. You can't predict which individual it's going to be. I mean, Senator Gazalka said for what he ran on Gull, those people would have a reduction. It could be on the other side of Gull if they're in a different school district. It would be different. But statewide, they're going to pay a little less. And the other thing with regard to ag land, this is seasonal rec, and it's like those two don't interact much. I mean, farming in Lake Country, there is some smart farming going on in Crowing and Cass, but not a lot. Now, Green Lake out west by Wilmer, that would be a little different deal, but that's more of an anomaly. The primary Lake Country north and east up that way isn't much ag land. So the ag relief in Representative, the property tax division report is separate from this in, with regard to school impacts.
Anything else, Representative Drazkowski?
Chair, to that point, I would point out that in our proposal it includes 2A, 2B, and 2C land. So it does include the forestry land too, Mr. Chair, and as Chair Lencheski pointed out, help people in northern Minnesota very similarly.
Anything further on?
As long as we're having this great conversation about property taxes and ag land, the Senate Education Committee did a real interesting take on something comparable to what you're proposing with regard to building levies for maintenance. They're proposing the aid mechanism for maintenance for ag land. Half of that be paid by the state into the value and half locally. So it's, in effect, a reduction for the facilities provision that they have, a reduction on half of the value for ag land that the state would be picking up. Similar to what your proposal is for the building levies, but a little different mechanism and outside of the tax arena they're doing in the school funding formula.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've got a question for the department. If I could go back very quickly to number 7, the grant to St. Louis County. Did the department have a position on that?
Do you? I don't know.
No? We do not.
Okay.
What? Oh, okay. I'll pick up.
Anything further then? And so we'll go to property tax payment postcard. Senator Gazelka.
Yeah. Well, this is a pretty simple piece of bill here, but I'll give you a little background first. I've been a business property owner for 30 years on 3 separate different buildings, and so I've paid my taxes regularly. One day I came back from an out-of-state trip and thought I'd get back by 5 o'clock. I got back about 5:15. I thought, well, I'll just pay it the next morning. Got in there at 8 a.m. and ended up having to pay about $400 more because I was late 15 minutes. She said, well, if you dropped it in the mail the day before, you would have been fine. So I said there ought to be a law then, but did nothing. So then recently, every time I pay property taxes, right on the 15th, I have my team members and my business make sure it gets in the mail. And just a little while later, I got a little bill in the mail for $400. And I thought, I went down to the courthouse and they said, this must be what's happening to a lot of other people, and that is that the post office no longer always postmarks your mail that you put in the mail the day you drop it, at least in rural Minnesota. And so they said, you can go through the appeal process and appeal to the county and go to before the board. And I said, we're not going to do that. It'll never happen to me again. But I don't think that should happen to anybody else either. So I was trying to figure out how do we, you know, we can't control what the United States Post Office is doing, but we should have a way of not penalizing people that are simply trying to pay their taxes, whether it's a resident or a business. But, you know, if it's a business, they're already paying twice as much, but then their penalty is also twice as much. And so I had a broader bill, but we scaled it down for this onto this bill that simply says if the postmark is within two business days of the due date, they don't have to pay the late payment. But Department of Revenue has some thoughts about that. They're a little concerned about the potential of a large business property owner using that to float it 2 days and wait. And I guess I'd let them make their case, and I'll let this group decide. But at the end of the day, if the post office doesn't postmark, I know a lot of people that think that that is gospel. You drop it, get in that blue box before the time, and that's the date. But that is no longer the case. And so somehow I hope we find a solution. They have an idea that I would go broader then, but we'll let this group decide.
Commissioner?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, and Senator Gazelka. Thank you for – we've had a great conversation, I think. We understand the concern and certainly want to make sure that people are being treated fairly. But I will start by saying that due dates are a very important thing to the Department of Revenue in general, and so we want to make sure that we don't start to erode the importance of those due dates, because at that point it becomes, personally for me, to feel very arbitrary about what point do we say this is within certain time frames or not. So we appreciate the conversation that we were able to have with you. We understand the concern, and as we've discussed, county boards, with the concurrence of a county treasurer at this point, do have the authority to abate penalties. But what we understand from this conversation is that the capacity to do that may not always be being exercised. They are actually having people go directly go through the board process as opposed to empowering a treasurer to be able to abate those penalties and that, of course, is a much longer process for taxpayers. So we do want to continue to offer you some ideas and some language to try to resolve the situation that you're describing without opening up a lot of other concerns about due dates and essentially just moving the due date 2 days, and then are we causing confusion? So does that really mean that the due date is 2 days later, and so then we're going to have a postmark that's 2 days after that, so now we're 4 days from the due date? And so we just want to try to clarify, I think, and address the particular situation you're concerned with without going too far beyond that. So we'd love to continue the conversation with you as soon as you're amenable. So thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any comments, Senator Skoy?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Zelka's provision?
I got to speak for this because I think what is happening here is it used to have every small town had a post office, and they had a stamp in the post office, and the mail got dropped into the box. And before 4 o'clock, the postmaster walked out there and picked them up, and he carried them inside and stamped them, and it worked just fine. And we operated with a postmark date for a long time, but that isn't the way it works anymore. If you're going to mail a letter from Gonvick to Clearbrook, well, I better say Clearbrook to Bagley, the letter goes to St. Cloud and comes back. And so it doesn't get postmarked until Monday instead of Friday or Saturday. And so, we're going to have some accommodation on this postmark issue because it isn't the same as it used to be when every town had a post office and they stamped them there and that was good to go. So I don't know what you're going to figure out, Senator Gazalka, but I'm supportive of it because I think it's an issue.
Senator Gazalka, and before that, too, I mean, I know that the department likes to, and counties, et cetera, likes people to pay their taxes electronically, and I don't run into that problem because mine comes right out of my bank account, and but that's not what is the case yet for probably the majority of property taxpayers. Senator Gazelka.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think the part I want to underscore as well is when I went in there, I said, this happens a lot. You know, and so it's like, well, if this happens a lot, then it's a problem. You know, and it's maybe not their fault, but, you know, so I'm, you know, I would settle for one postmark day. I mean, but, you know, point being is we've got to find a way to accommodate this. We're inconveniencing the people that are trying to pay the taxes, and they shouldn't have to pay a penalty for doing it right.
Anything further on that? Our next item, Senator Skoy, this is also yours. It's on the side-by-side page 63. It's dealing with the reserve. As you know, last year we included on tax bill the taking of a third of any reserve or any surplus that was determined after the November 4th or at the November forecast. One third of that surplus went into the reserve. We did that for this year. And then this is an extension of that and changing the date. Senator Skoy, you want to explain how we got there?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. What this provision does is this reestablishes the amount of the budget reserve at the dollar amount that is actually in there now, $984 million. And then it makes a date change for MMB to use when they are calculating what is available to go into the budget reserve, but the date would be after the legislative session. Currently, the date is January, and I think we're moving it to August. I don't remember exactly what the date is. Moving it to July. No, August. An August reporting. And the reason for that is so that any activities that the legislature would take during the legislative session would be taken into account when MMB is calculating what would be going into the budget reserve.
Any questions about that provision? Commissioner Bowerly, anything?
We do not have any comments at this time, Madam Chair.
And then, Representative Davids, the last thing on our list today that are Senate provisions and not House provisions are the public finance article. That's Article 10 in the Senate bill. And the most of the provisions are to allow the types of financing that support eliminating the R-22 from ice rinks around the state, whether they're school districts or counties, cities, whatever, that the term of the financing be increased to 20 years. And there is a provision that allows general obligation revenue bonds for housing HRAs to be increased from $3 million to $5 million. And the article eliminates the requirement that notices from economic development authorities be published in daily newspapers, because some communities don't have daily newspapers, so and there was no objection to that from the newspaper association. So it could be in any newspaper of general circulation in the city. And then it allows cities to approve a plan for street reconstruction with a majority vote rather than the current unanimous vote. And then a technical change of a term that would change a reference to financial advisor to municipal advisor, and that's in conjunction with what is the common practice with SEC. There were other provisions in the bill that were removed because they were unnecessary, turned out. It was a little bit longer bill than that, but this is what ended up being left. And the bill was heard both in the Education Committee, because some of these ice rinks are owned by school districts, and also we did have a provision that dealt with a change in the law that used to require permission to be granted from the department for capital expenditures for lease purchase agreements. And we got rid of the permission language, but then didn't have a paragraph that dealt with getting approval. And so that's what the first one does. It just clarifies it. And yes, indeed, okay, permission, the language is gone, but the approval is still needed, and that was gone from the statute, even though we knew that's a common practice. So that's there and clarifies that. I think rather uncomplicated and not. Sometimes public finance provisions have asked for some extreme things that the legislature has routinely denied, like bonding software. We didn't allow that to happen because we want things to have a useful life of 20 years if you're going to bond for it. But they kept trying. But we didn't do that. So that's what the public finance article is in the Senate, Mr. Chairman. Any questions on that? Commissioner Ballard, you all have an opinion on our public finance article?
We do not have any comments at this time, Madam Chair.
That's it. That's our list of things, Mr. Chairman. Representative Davids, and I do, I guess, the Senate now does have a full copy of the updated 11:42 a.m. Spreadsheet. Would it be helpful if the staff explain what changes were made to get to this point? Ms. McQuay, that'd be okay. Should we do that briefly? Ms. McQuay, just mention where the changes were that you worked out with the House getting the, based on the amendments that we made too. What changed in the spreadsheet from the original one that was handed out?
Madam Chair, there were sort of three major categories of changes. There were some updated revenue estimates that the department got to us in time to publish this new spreadsheet. There was some staff clarification in working it out between House, Senate, and MMB on where to carry certain provisions, including the stadium reserve account, taconite, and the tax court. Those were sort of added or clarified on where they should be included. And then the third change is just a general clarification of certain provisions. So if you want us to go through each of those specifically, we can certainly do that. And would this be the appropriate time to do that?
Representative Davids, anybody feel the need to have the detail on that? Representative Joskowski?
Madam Chair, I'm looking back at the public finance article.
Okay.
Can we go back to that?
Sure. Let's just get this issue. Was there any of the fiscal analysts for House Research have any additional comments about changes that were made in the spreadsheet beyond what Mr. Clay indicated?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, just in addition to the changes that Ms. McQuay mentioned, there is also corrections to estimates on the non-general fund page, too.
Senator Skoy?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe Ms. McQuay could walk us through the new box on the front page. Stadium Reserve Account.
Madam Chair and members, this was a change clarification and further review of the House position to reduce lawful gambling changes, and I'll ask that Ms. Templin actually walk you through the changes to those lines.
Mr. Chair, I think that it would be best to start that discussion by turning to page 7 of the spreadsheet, and that shows the lawful gambling tax changes. And on line 221, that line shows the total change provisions to the lawful gambling tax. And as you can see in the 16-17 biennium, there's $30.6 million in reductions. Starting with that biennium.
Excuse me. Could you indicate the line again?
Line 220, thank you, on page 7.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just to repeat, the lawful gambling tax change items in the House bill total $30.6 million in the 16-17 biennium. And those changes, or the reduction in revenues for lawful gambling, have the effect of reducing the amount of revenue for stadium finance. And as a result, that has a flow through to the stadium reserve account. And that we don't generally see in the tax spreadsheet, but it flows through to the bottom line. And that is what you see going On the fiscal summary page, you can see that that has a reduction. It accelerates the usage of the stadium account reserve. So under current law, if you look at that box on the summary page, page one, the current law balance of the stadium reserve at the end of fiscal 17 is $6.840 million. And in fiscal 18, that account is drawn down to $2.3999 million. And by fiscal 19, under current law, that account is zero. With the House's proposed changes, the account is drawn down to $3.384 million in fiscal 16 and $0 million in fiscal 17. So that has the effect, the House changes have the effect of drawing down the reserve by 2 years earlier than under current law.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scorn.
And that's a result of the activity on line 220.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Anyone else have a question on the spreadsheet or that would like further explanation from Ms. McQuay or Ms. Templin?
Madam Chair, I would just also add that there were additions to revenues and expenditures, and there also were some changes that reversed or modified those to the negative. Overall, the House position changed and the Senate position changed. Both less than $5 million. The Senate coming, the first spreadsheet that you saw, the House reduced revenues $2.271 billion in the first biennium, and the Senate $457.6 million. And the change now reflected on the spreadsheet is $2.270 in the first biennium for the House and $460 0.9 for the Senate. So the changes sort of netted out to a lesser amount than individual provisions change the items.
Okay. Going back to the public finance article, I want to clarify one thing. If you look at that first section, I had it backwards, I think. It was that prior law said they had to file, the school districts had to file an application, but it really didn't talk about what happened to the application. And the application was to get permission. And so that section one of this article clarifies that they really do have to, school districts have to get permission from the commissioner for the for that lease levy proposal. But Representative Druskowski, did you have other questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question was on the same section. And
okay.
I was just reading on page 150 of the Senate bill.
Yep.
And it appears, as I read the language, that we are... The old language, or the existing law, says an application for permit to levy under the subdivision must contain financial information for the proposed levy, the terms and the conditions of the proposed lease, and a description of the space to be leased, and et cetera. And then the new language says, in granting permission to levy under this subdivision, the commissioner may consider the financial justification for the proposed levy, the terms and conditions of proposed lease and description of the space to be leased, and its proposed use. I don't know. In my first read of that, it appeared that we were requiring less information of the school district, and maybe I'm not reading that properly.
Representative Druskowski, I don't believe that's the case. I believe that the information has just been. I'm sorry, that the information that required or that the commissioner may ask for as much information as the commissioner deems necessary in order to decide whether the school district will be permitted to do that
or not. And additional information shall be, and that word probably should be, must be provided upon the request of the commissioner. So the commissioner can require as much financial information as the commissioner deems necessary in order to deal with the request. That's how I read it. Commissioner Bowerly, any different read on it than that, or?
Madam Chair, I think we don't have a different read on it, but I think if I might, Madam Chair and members and Representative Juskowski, perhaps we could take a look at the current requirements and compare them if that's helpful.
That'd be fine with me.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, that concludes the items that the Senate had to be brought up today. And at this point, we're ready to conclude for today. And I wondered if you would share what your plans are for tomorrow.
Thank you, Chair Reston. Thank you for the discussion on the Senate provisions. I think it was very helpful. First of all, I'd just like to announce that if House conferees can meet in room 585 of the state office building, that's Cold Spring Grove Pop, and it's I'll be willing to chair. It's my intention to meet 1/2 hour after the second body adjourns, so the last body adjourns, but we don't really have an agenda set right now, so the situation's fluid. If we would miraculously get numbers tonight or tomorrow morning, we'll have plenty to do. If we don't get numbers, we may have nothing to do, and then we would cancel, and then the next day, of course, we would have the gavel.
Sure.
The Senate would have the gavel, and that's certainly fine. And just to address something to the folks that are here, there's been some talk. I think we've all read Leader Bach's comments about there may be no tax bill this year. For me, that's like not having Christmas. But with that being said, I think we're all aware. We've all been around. You know, I was born on a day, but it wasn't yesterday, and I understand that they have to do at that level what they have to do. It's my intent to work very diligently with the Senate and House conferees on a tax bill. I think the state needs a tax bill this year. But to the folks that are in this room, other than members and staff, I would just say, please don't come to my office or call me and say, we understand there's not going to be a tax bill, but could we have DMC? Or could we have this provision or that provision or the other provision? Because it's my belief that there will be one tax bill or there will be zero tax bills. There won't be 84 tax bills. Can you imagine Chair Lencheski going to the floor with 84 separate tax bills? I can't. So just kind of an announcement to... So just for my friends that are representing various fine institutions, don't even come to my door. Don't even darken my door thinking that there's going to be this tax bill, that tax bill, or the other tax bill, unless it's tax reciprocity. Then, of course, we would have to consider it fully. But with that being said, I would just say at this point the situation is, well, I don't know, Chair Scott or Chair Rest, if you have any comments. I mean, I get what's going on. I'm hoping we can have a robust tax bill that meets the needs of what the senators are looking at and the House members are looking at. So that's where I'm coming from. But just don't come to my door.
Well,
you can come to my door anytime you like. I've got Spring Grove Pop grape in my favorite. So.
Representative Davids, I think I may be the only one person who was able to take a provision that is in the Senate tax bill dealing with estate tax, tuck it into another bill, and it's on its way to the governor. So there are at least two tax bills, this one and Senator Thompson's bill that we passed off the floor of the Senate, a modest improvement in estates that have Q-tip trusts. So that's gone. And so at least, but And members always try to do that, even if there is a tax, a major tax bill, to find a home for their provisions.
Never underestimate my sneakiness.
Yeah. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. We've kind of reached the end of our list of things that were just in the Senate bill that we wanted to talk about. But I think there are a number of provisions in your bill and our bill that are similar. I know they have money attached to them mostly, but there are some language issues to resolve that I think you might want to start thinking about. The one that comes to mind right away is the workforce housing requirements, that we have some differences there. I think we have some differences with regard to what's qualified for the bullion sales tax exemption. So I think we'll see if there's some of those that maybe we can work on in the next day or two, where they're in both bills, they're similar, but they're not identical, and there'll be some decisions to be made about those, and then there'll be the final decision as to whether they're going to be adopted or not. But if we could resolve some of that, might be helpful in case targets take a little bit longer than we would like them to. So,
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Chair Rest, and that Chair Skoy, that's a very, very good point, and we'll look at putting together an agenda possibly with the housing issue. Another one, the bullion, another one comes to mind is DMC. We put that off the other day because we have a few differences there. So I guess we should figure on having a meeting half hour after the last body adjourns, unless you hear from us differently. Hopefully we have targets, but I've got a feeling we might not. So with that, plan on meeting tomorrow half hour.
And that's our understanding, too. Exactly the same as yours. So if there's no further business before the conference committee, we stand adjourned for the call of the chair, but most likely half an hour after the last body adjourns.
Thank you, Chair Rest.